10. Okay, we talked about the very interesting, and they're really side issues, of Daniel. He's an old man now, as you recall, and he sees this manifestation of the pre-incarnate Christ. You recall that, students? And he keeps fainting. I thought that was, you know, the text has the ring of authenticity about it, doesn't it? That's the very thing we would expect. Daniel is not some superhero. He's certainly not an object of mythology. The poor guy keeps fainting and having to be revived. Had to be true. And Daniel's writing this. He's saying, boy, I had a terrible time of it. I couldn't hardly stay awake through the vision. Because why was he so tired? Or why was he so weak? Been fasting for how long? 3 weeks. Then the impact of this. And keep in mind, he didn't see visions every day. He thought, here, I can just see Daniel. Oh, here we go again. I'm wore out. anyway. Come to verse 15 of chapter 10. And when he had spoken to me according to these words, I turned my face toward the ground and became speechless. Behold, one who resembles a human being was touching my lips. Then I opened my mouth and spoke, and he said to him, who was standing before me, O my Lord, as a result of the vision, anguish has come upon me, and I have retained no strength. For how can such a servant of my Lord take talk with such as my Lord? How can somebody like me do business with somebody like you? Somebody close those, pull those blinds in the back, that glare makes it difficult for me. Thank you. Appreciate that. Then this one with a human appearance touched me again and strengthened me. And he said, O man of high esteem, do not be afraid. Peace be with you. It comes out kind of elegant in this translation. He said, calm down. You're okay. Take courage and be courageous. He's encouraging us. You're going to be okay. You're going to live through this. It was like a parent encouraging a child. You know, you're not going to die. Now, as soon as he spoke to me, I received strength. Was it supernatural strength? Don't know. Doesn't make a difference. And said, may my Lord speak, for you have strengthened me. So, okay, well, you get what he's saying? Okay, I can go on now. Go ahead and talk. I'm okay. Then he said, do you understand why I came to you? But I shall now return to fight against the prince of Persia. So I'm going forth, and behold, the prince of Greece is about to come, Alexander. And this whole discussion we've had of spiritual warfare, the demonic hierarchy and all of that, which I'm not going to repeat, of course. However, I will tell you what is inscribed in the writing of truth. This is an idiom, what's written. Yet there is no one who stands firmly with me against those forces except Michael, your prince. So the spirit, what he's saying is, this, I'm going to tell you what's going to happen, but the spiritual warfare continues, the issues. Okay, so really all that chapter 10 of the book of Daniel is, as you've seen, is the introduction to the vision. The appearance, Daniel's reaction, the vision introduced. Now we come to chapter 11. And in the first year of Darius the Mede, I arose to be an encouragement and a protection for him. That's 538. This pre-incarnate Christ is still speaking. I protected him for my purposes, my reasons, I take it. And I will understand that Christ was involved in that, the fall of Babylon. We know that he was, that God was. But now I will tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings are going to arise in Persia, then a fourth, who will gain far more riches than all of them, and as soon as he becomes strong through his riches, he will arouse the whole empire against the realm of Greece. And a mighty king will arise, and he will rule with great authority and do as he pleases. Now, as we begin this, First of all, let me remind you, he's not dealing with this is an appearance to him, and this is a vision he's having, or maybe it's not a vision, that is, it may just be an appearance, understand, not a vision. And there's no beasts or symbolism here. He's just telling him what's going to happen. That is, the vision, if there is a vision, is simply this figure telling him this. There are no animals to interpret, no metals in the beast, no toes, no little horns, none of that. He's just telling him. Now, look what I say in I comment on verse 20. He's already indicated in chapter 10, verse 20, that what he is about to say forebodes evil for the Persian Empire. Why? The Prince of Greece is coming. Alexander the Great, as we know, who destroyed the Persian Empire. Now, he said, and he's already said, I must go back to the struggle that I came from. This high-level warfare we've talked about. And so now we come to page 52. The specific prophecies concerning the future of God's people. Beginning with verse 11:2. Three kings are going to arise in Persia. Verse 2, we've read this. This revelation was given in 536 B.C., the third year of Cyrus, the founder of the Persian Empire. Cyrus ruled from 539 to 530, and his three immediate successors, I list here, Cambyses, Gautama, and Darius Hystaspes, to distinguish him from the other Dariuses. Okay? These are the three kings. Now, there were more than four kings after Cyrus. The emphasis in Daniel's revelation seems to be upon the four kings whose policies lead up to a confrontation with Macedonia and Greece. There will be three kings, then the fourth one. And the fourth one is going to do what? Cause trouble with Greece. Now, the fourth king is Xerxes, or Ahasuerus of Esther. Xerxes is same word. Ahasuerus, you get transliterated through a couple of languages, he comes out Ahasuerus or Xerxes. Now, did this king, as a matter of fact, stir up trouble with Greece? Certainly did. Remember in Western Civ 1, those of you who had that course, we talked about the two Persian kings who tried to take Europe. The first one was Darius, and he was turned back at Marathon. You recall that, our discussion of that. The second one was Xerxes, who actually took Athens, but he was defeated at the naval battle of Salamis, and winter came, and the final battle the next year was the Battle of Plataea, and it failed. Remember, Xerxes sits up on the hill and watches his fleet destroyed when the Greeks trapped them in the Bay of Salamis. You all remember all that. But anyway, some of you do. The point is that this took place. Prophecy was true. And I outlined this for you in the syllabus. In 490, Darius the First invaded Macedonia and Greece. They were turned back at the famous Battle of Marathon. In 480, Xerxes invaded. The oppression of the Greek colonies, I put in capital letters now, on the mainland of Asia Minor and the invasion of the Hellenistic homelands was the pretext of Alexander's invasion of Persia in the 4th century. That is, look here, there will arise three kings, then the fourth one was Xerxes. And Xerxes is the one, note this, Darius caused trouble with Greece. It was Xerxes who took Athens. What we're saying is that the prophecy connects this with the coming of the Prince of Greece, and we know that Alexander used this as a pretext for invading Persia, to pay them back for destroying Athens. Now, that was a pretext. Why? Well, Alexander, his purpose in invading Persia was not simply to avenge the invasions by Darius and Xerxes. He wanted a world empire for whatever reasons we're not really sure about. You understand? He used that as a talking point. His purposes went much more beyond. What I'm saying is the purposes of Alexander went much more beyond simple revenge. But it's very unlikely he would have got the Greeks to follow him as far as they did had the Persians not invaded before and looted and burned Athens. As you know, when Alexander got to Babylon, he found the statuary that had been taken, the Xerxes army had taken out of Athens, he sent it back. Much of it. Okay. Now, and a mighty king, verse 3, and a mighty king will arise, and he will rule with great authority and do as he pleases. But as soon as he has arisen, his kingdom will be broken up and parceled out toward the four points of the compass, though not to his own descendants, nor according to his authority, which he wielded for his sovereignty, will be uprooted and given to others beside him. Now, this is a who? Alexander and the Didache. We've talked about those before. We met them before. The four horn, remember the notable horn that's broken off, and four horns sprout up. So that, it's interesting, it's exactly right. Those who took over Alexander's empire were not his descendants. They were his generals, the Didache. And Lysimachus, Ptolemy Seleucid, and Antigonus. Four. Okay. Now, so much, very simple. Now it begins to get tough. Then the king of the south will grow strong along with one of his princes who will gain ascendancy over him and obtain dominion. His dominion will be a great dominion indeed. Now, who's the king of the south? What is the south? Egypt. Now, this map, this is the Roman Empire, and this is too early, this is too late. But you recall the maps. That is, the Ptolemies took over Egypt. Ptolemy Soter means Ptolemy the Savior. Greek term. Ptolemy Soter grew strong. He obtained Egypt and ruled it from 322 to 305. This is verse 5. So verse 5 simply speaks of Ptolemy Soter. It's not too hard to interpret this. Egypt is the south. Verse 6. And after some years, they will form an alliance, and the daughter of the king of the south will come to the king of the north to carry out a peaceful arrangement. But she will not retain her position of power, nor will he remain with his power, but she will be given up along with those who brought her in, and the one who sired her, as well as he who supported her in these times. Now, number one, you can see why the critics say, well, this had to be written after the fact. Why? Because it's so very specific. Well, does that prove it? It doesn't prove anything at all. It was written before the fact. Now here you have the exception to the general rule that prophecy is given in vague, somewhat vague symbols, dreams, visions. Here you have this exception. Now, in verse 6. This ill-fated alliance between the north and the south. And I give you the details here, what verse 6 is talking about. Ptolemy Philadelphus and Antiochus II, King Ptolemy in Egypt, Antiochus up in north, 35 years after the death of Seleucus, were trying to work out an agreement that would keep the peace. Bernice, he's this daughter of the king of the south, her name is Bernice, who's the daughter of Ptolemy, was to marry Antiochus II to seal the treaty. See, this is what verse 6 says. She's to carry out a peaceful arrangement, make a treaty. Antiochus was already married to Laodice, and by her had two sons, Seleucus, Callinicus, and Antiochus. Antiochus was forced to divorce her and marry Bernice. 2 years later, Ptolemy died. Antiochus divorced Bernice and remarried Laodice. As his father had forced the marriage, his father died, he went back to his original wife. Laodice, determined to secure the throne for one of her sons, had Antiochus poisoned and encouraged Seleucus to murder Bernice and her infant son. This was to secure the throne for Seleucus. Well, the point is, you can read those details. It says, but what the basic point in verse 6 is that this arrangement, this treaty by marriage, which is a very common custom, broke down because of this death and these plots, poisonings, so that it had to be given up. It didn't work out. You can review the details. Now we come to verse 7. You stop me. This is the boring part of Daniel. It gets better later on. Not a whole lot better, but it does get better later on. So you're with me in the lion's den. You're with me in the fiery furnace. We withstood the four beasts. So stick with me now, okay? I know it's tough. Verse 7. Aren't you excited about verse 7, everybody? Oh. Verse 7. I mean, let me ask you, is this a verse? But one of the descendants of her line will arise in his place, and he will come against their army and enter the fortress of the king of the north, and he will deal with them and display great strength. And also their gods with their metal images and their precious vessels of silver and gold he will take into captivity into Egypt, and he on his part will refrain from attacking the king of the north for some years. Now outline the details of this. One of her relatives avenges Bernice. Ptolemy Eugertes, that means doing good work, a brother of Bernice, carried out a military expedition against Seleucus and put the murderers of his sister to death, including Laodice. But Laodicea is named for her. The taking of the paraphernalia connected with the Syrian gods indicates the completeness of the victory. Some year, that is, the ceasing of this, kind of like taking the vessels of the temple into the temple of Marduk. It was some years before he could attack the enemy to the north again. Verse 9, then the latter will enter the realm of the king of the south and will return to his own land. This speaks of the unsuccessful attempt, E is verse 9, the unsuccessful attempt, about 240 B.C., of Seleucus Callinicus to avenge the invasion. So what we're talking about is the wars, but basically what we're talking about is the wars between the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. Okay, these Hellenistic empires. Now we come to verse 10. And his sons will mobilize and assemble a multitude of great forces, and one of them will keep on coming and overflow and pass through that he may again wage war up to the very fortress. F is verse 10. The sons of the king of the north assert themselves against the Ptolemies down south. I gave you the names, Seleucus Cyrenus and Antiochus the Great are the sons spoken of here. Now Antiochus the Great is the son of, is the father of Antiochus Epiphanes, who we've met before. Seleucus Cyrenus died in battle in Asia Minor, but Antiochus the Great, a great military success, he took Phoenicia and Palestine and established himself at Gaza. That's the fortress spoken about in verse 10. He may again wage war up to his very fortress. Now it is here that this is when Palestine falls under Palestine, which has been Ptolemaic. And this is in 198 B.C. becomes Seleucid. You understand? And later on, we have to get into the history a little bit. When, under Antiochus, his son Antiochus Epiphanes, we have the desecration of the temple, the offering of the pig, see? The Jews look back upon the days, still remembered when they were ruled by the Egyptians, by the Ptolemies, as that was the golden age, the good old days. They long, understand, because the Ptolemies the Ptolemies didn't suppress their religion. The Ptolemies didn't treat them like that. It was the Seleucids who did, understand? So it was 198 B.C. when what we call Palestine. You understand it was not called Palestine then. The Romans called it Palestine after
It was renamed after the Jewish revolts, and it became a Roman province, and they really put their heavy hand on it. They called it Palestine. Okay. Verses 11 through 13, the continuing war between the north and the south. And the king of the south will be enraged and go forth and fight with the king of the north. Then the latter will raise a great multitude, that that multitude will be given to the hand of the former. When the multitude is carried away, his heart will be lifted up. He will cause tens of thousands to fall, yet he will not prevail. For the king of the north will again raise a great multitude, and a greater multitude than the former. And after an interval of some years, he will press on with a great army and much equipment. And I outline this for you at the bottom of page 53 of the syllabus. The continuing war between the north and the south. He speaks of in Daniel, what is promised, what is prophesied, is a great war. That's the picture that emerges, does it not? Great multitude, verse 11. Tens of thousands fall, verse 12. Greater multitude raised in verse 13. Did that happen? It happened precisely that way. Antiochus the Great, the Seleucid, raised an army of 70,000 infantry, 5,000 cavalry, and 73 elephants, which were the super weapons, the tanks of the ancient world. They really were. Against the Ptolemies, Ptolemy Philopater. At the Battle of Raphia, Ptolemy defeated Antiochus. According to Polybius, the historian, I gave you this place here, 586, Antiochus lost 10,000 foot soldiers, 300 cavalry, and 5 elephants, and 4,000 of his men were taken prisoner. He did not benefit from his victory. Daniel says, in this vision it said, he will not prevail. He defeated Antiochus, but he was more interested in his vices and self-indulgence. He did not press his advantage. That is, he did not take Palestine back. He could have at this time. 13 years later, this is in verse 13, it says, he will again raise a great multitude. Antiochus will try again. Y'all with me? Antiochus loses, but Ptolemy does not press his advantage. So Antiochus tries again. Verse 13. 13 years later, Antiochus, largely due to military successes in the east, was once again ready to bring a powerful force against the Ptolemies. Philopater was dead, his only child was 4 years old. Verses 14 through 19 tell of the final defeat and humiliation of Antiochus the Great. Now keep in mind that this is not Antiochus Epiphanes, this is his father. Okay. Now in those times, many will rise up against the king of the south. The violent ones among your people will also lift themselves up in order to fulfill the vision, but they will fall down. Then the king of the north, well, that is, verse 14, the Jews in league with Antiochus the Great, what verse 14 prophesies, Ptolemy Philopater had regained Palestine. Many Jews, thinking they were fulfilling prophecy, worked from within to overthrow Ptolemaic rule. Verse 15 talks about the siege and capture of Sidon. Then the king of the north will come, cast up a siege mound, capture a well-fortified city at Sidon, and the forces of the south will not stand their ground, not even their choice troops, for there will be no strength to make a stand. Now, Scopas, who was the chief lieutenant of Ptolemy, was defeated by Antiochus at Sidon in this battle for Palestine. Verse 16, but he who comes against him will do as he pleases. That's an idiom that means very arrogant, powerful man. And no one will be able to withstand him. He will also stay for a time in the beautiful land, that's Palestine, with destruction in his hand. This is Antiochus and his prideful domination of Palestine. Number 4. And then this brings us to verse 17. the attempt of Antiochus to gain the south by political means. And he will set his face to come with the power of his whole kingdom, bringing with him a proposal of peace, which he will put into effect. He also will give him the daughter of women to ruin it, but she will not take a stand for him or be on his side. Now, what's he talking about there? Antiochus worked out a treaty with Ptolemy calling for the marriage of his daughter Cleopatra to the young king. Now, this is not the Cleopatra of the movie. This is one of her ancestors. Now, that is, he tried to work out an alliance through marriage, take over the country that way, take over Egypt. Since the king of Egypt was only 7 years old when the treaty was arranged, the wedding could not take place for 5 years, because he was 12. It didn't work out. Why? Because Cleopatra took the side of her father. That is, if she had sided with her husband, if she had sided with her father, then Antiochus could have worked out his plans, used her, but she sided with her husband. It was not what he had in mind at all, so it didn't work. Now we come to verse 18. Got this? She will not take a stand for him or be on his side. That's what that means. Now you can review this in the syllabus. That's one reason I put this in there, because you can go back and read it, because it gets very complicated. When you get to this, you want to say, who's on first? Then he will turn his face to the coastlands and capture many, but a commander will put a stop to his scorn against him. Moreover, he will repay him for his scorn. This is verse 18. It says he will turn his face to the coastlands. Antiochus campaigns against the islands and the coast of the Mediterranean Sea. He's defeated. Antiochus had a very haughty attitude toward the Romans. This is spoken of, and it says, but a commander will put a stop to his scorn against him. See, the Romans are beginning to emerge. The Romans have become the major power in the Western Mediterranean. The Romans are beginning to move east at a time when Antiochus is trying to move west. That's what we're looking at here. This is the general historical context. Antiochus had a very haughty attitude, the scorn spoken of in verse 18, toward the Romans. When Hannibal, listen to this, remember him, the elephants, the famous Hannibal? When Hannibal, the Carthaginian, there's Carthage, of course, these are called the Punic Wars. We studied Western Civ 1, the Punic Wars, the word Punic, listen, the word Punic is the same word as Phoenician, because Carthage was a Phoenician city, hence the Punic Wars. When Hannibal, the Carthaginian, was defeated by the Romans at Zama, you recall that Hannibal invaded Italy, and so the Romans, to get him out of Italy, invaded Carthage. And Hannibal had to come home to defend his city, which didn't work. He was defeated at Zama. Zama's in North Africa. Bringing to an end the Second Punic War, he fled east to the court of Antiochus the Great. You understand? Antiochus, or Hannibal, had to head for the high country, the boonies, and so he had one place to go east to the court of Hannibal, to the court of Antiochus. Hannibal, look at this very, Hannibal persuaded Antiochus to invade Greece. Up this way. They did. That is, who was controlling Greece? You see, Rome. In the Pyrrhic Wars, which took place before the Punic Wars, Rome was now in control of Greece. And Hannibal had a real mouth on him, I guess. He had just lost to the Romans, and so he's trying to get even and do whatever he's trying to do. So he gets Antiochus to attack the Romans. Well, what happened? Rome declared war on Antiochus. They moved on him, defeated him, forced him to retreat back to Asia Minor. There at Magnesia, between Sardis and Smyrna, the Romans, right in here, here's Smyrna, here's Sardis, Magnesia, between there, they had a big dairy farm there. You've heard of the milk of Magnesia?
Makes a class
worthwhile. I wonder why you pay your tuition to get the good stuff. The Romans at Magnesia, there I pointed in the map. Where am I? There at Sardis, there at Magnesia, between Sardis and Smyrna, the Romans, led by Cornelius Scipio, defeated Antiochus again. Understand? They pursued him. My point is, students, they ran him out of Greece, which he had invaded at the instigation of Hannibal, and the Romans pursued him into Asia Minor. That's now Turkey, Anatolia. Antiochus was forced to pay a huge indemnity. He had to surrender his navy and his elephants. He had to pay the Romans, you know, indemnity is, for their trouble. To ensure the payment of the indemnity, the Romans took hostage the younger son of Antiochus, Antiochus IV Epiphanes, you see. And for 12 years he was in Rome. Now, he wasn't in jail, but he was in protected custody. Understand? The Antiochus Epiphanes, who desecrated the temple, and spent 12 years as a young man in Rome as a hostage until his father could pay the indemnity. And it was all paid, and he came home. It was a tremendous amount of money. And therefore he had great appreciation for Roman power. Remember, I think I mentioned there's a great scene later on. It's not mentioned here. Make sure I don't get ahead of myself here. One time Antiochus, one of the great stories in ancient history, and I think I told it in Western City, I wanted to remind you, remember Antiochus is moving on Egypt and his army, and it's a little cloud of dust on the horizon, and it's two people. It's a Roman legate and his personal servant. A legate's an official representative of the emperor of Rome, wasn't a republic, but an emperor yet, of the Senate, legate, senatorial legate. And he says to Antiochus, Rome says, stay out of Egypt. And Antiochus didn't want to be embarrassed. He said, well, I'll think about it. And the legate took out his sword and drew a circle in the dirt around Antiochus. He said, you think about it, but you give me an answer before you step out of that circle. And he decided he'd go back home. But how could two men turn Antiochus around? The answer is they were Romans. And he had spent 12 years in Rome, and he knew that the Romans meant business. And so he went, that's quite an interesting story, but you see, well, that's an aside. Okay. Now we're still talking about Antiochus the Great. Come to verse 19. So he will turn his face toward the fortresses of his own land, but he will stumble and fall and be found no more. That is, in the last days of his reign, the best he can do, he tries to maintain his own territory, turn his face to his own fortresses. As before, Antiochus the Great had even attacked Greece, challenged the Romans. But in his latter days, not only can he not expand his empire as he tried to do, he can barely defend it. That's what the text says. Now, we come to verse 20. The immediate successor is your friend and mine, Antiochus Epiphanes. Then in his place one will arise who will send an oppressor through the jewel of his kingdom. Yet within a few days he will be shattered, though neither in anger nor in battle. Now, the immediate successor of Antiochus the Great in his unhappy reign. Antiochus the Great was killed in the year 187 by fierce tribesmen. He had gone to seize the treasury at Elymais, and that he needed to pay this Roman indemnity to get his son out. Antiochus IV was in Rome. He, along with Seleucus IV, was joint king legally, even though he was in Rome at the time when he became to the throne. From this time, the Seleucid kingdom ceased to be a great empire as it had been before its war with Rome. The oppressor or exactor of tribute, he will arise and will send an oppressor to the jewel of his kingdom. This was Heliodorus, his prime minister. He became thoroughly hated when he tried to take the temple treasury. The mysterious death to which verse 20 alludes, understand, this oppressor is Heliodorus, the prime minister of Antiochus IV. The mysterious death to which verse 20 alludes is historically verified. Polybius tells about it. Seleucus died mysteriously, poisoning is suspected, possibly at the hand of Heliodorus. And this brings Antiochus IV to the scene, verses 21 through 35. In this place, a despicable person will arise, on whom the kingship and the honor of kingship has not been conferred, but he will come in a time of tranquility and seize the kingdom by intrigue. He was not born to the throne. He's not in line for it. He was a despicable person. Verse 21. Young says about him, he was both avaricious and prodigal, excessive in his indulgences, and prone to violent passions, a compound of the veriest folly and weakness in some respects, and of great cunning and dexterity in some others, especially in regard to flattery. His enemies gave him the nickname Epimenes. He called himself Epiphanes, which means God manifest. And very quickly, they called him Epimenes, play on a pun, which means madman. He assumed the throne by intrigue, not by warfare or acclamation, as the prophecies suggest. Verse 22, and the overflowing forces will be flooded away before him and shattered, and also the prince of the covenant. The overflowing forces have reference to the rout of the forces of Egypt between Pelusium and the Cassian Mountains. He won military victory. Verse 22 says, and also the prince of the covenant. We don't know who this was. This was some prince with whom Antiochus had entered into a covenant relationship. Who was it? I list the possibilities here. This is simply an obscure point in history. We don't know. You can read those. He gains power, according to verse 23, with a small force of people. Now, what does this mean? A reference to the comparative small size of Syria? Or the reference to the small number of partisans who helped him gain control of the Syrian government? We don't know. The point is, he wormed his way into position through intrigue and force and time, but no great war. Antiochus lulled the people into a false sense of security, and then he, in various ways, seized personal and national wealth to finance his extravagant way of living. This is prophesied in verse 24. In a time of tranquility, he will enter the richest parts of the realm. He will accomplish what his fathers never did, nor his ancestors. He will distribute plunder, booty, and possessions among them. He will devise his schemes and against strongholds, but only for a time. Verse 24. He makes plans to invade Egypt. You understand? He will devise schemes against, see that phrase, he will devise his schemes against strongholds. Then verse 25 speaks of his first Egyptian campaign. He will stir up his strength and courage against the king of the south with a large army. So the king of the south will mobilize an extremely large and mighty army for war, but he will not stand, for schemes will be devised against him. And those who eat his choice food will destroy him, and his army will overflow, but many will fall down slain. As for both kings, their hearts will be intent on evil. They will speak lies to each other at the same table. They will not succeed, for the end is still to come at the appointed time. Then he will return to his land with much plunder, but his heart will be set against the Holy Covenant. He will take action and return to his own land. Now, what does that mean? This is the first, verses 25 through 28, as I point out in the syllabus, speaks of the first Egyptian campaign. Now, let me check here and see how we're coming out of time. Two more discussions? No, three more. Yeah, we're going to come out okay. Okay, we're coming out just right. I want to see how much time I had to spend on this, but we're going to come out just right, I think, on our discussions. Okay. Now, I outlined this first Egyptian campaign, verses 25 through 28, is the prophecy of it. Antiochus moves on Egypt. The king of Egypt could not successfully defend his country because many who claimed to support him did not. Those who ate at his table, verse 26, this is speaking of the king of the south. They betrayed him. His army was swept away. He suffered heavy casualties. The Egyptian forces were routed at Pelusium. And then Egypt was invaded in two factions. I'll give you the historical sources. Both kings, their hearts will be intent on evil, the two factions. Verse 27, prophesies the attempt to be S-I-S. The attempts of Antiochus and Ptolemy Philometor to deceive one another and attempt to take over Egypt. They could not succeed because it was not the God-appointed time for it to take place. Antiochus returns from Egypt with much spoil and proceeds to loot the temple. Misspelled. To loot the temple. And I give you the source. This is verse 28. Then he will return to his land with much plunder, but his heart will be set against the Holy Covenant, and he will take action and then return to his own land. Now, so that is, he came back and looted the temple. He didn't. This is not when he desecrated it. This is when he just looted it. And First Maccabees tells the account of this. On his return from the conquest of Egypt in the year 143, Antiochus marched with a strong force against Israel and Jerusalem. In his arrogance, he entered the temple and carried off the golden altar, the lampstand with all its equipment, the table for the bread of the presence, sacred cups and the bowls, the golden censers, the curtain, the crown, and the crowns. He stripped off all the gold plating from the temple front. He seized the silver, gold, and precious vessels, and whatever secret treasures he found, took them all with him, and he left for his own country. He had caused, that is, back to Damascus up north. He had caused much bloodshed, and he gloated over all he had done. Aren't you glad that's over? Well, I don't need any other way to teach this in the time we have available to us. But so what I've done, like I say, you can go back and he just tells about in broad outlines what's going to happen to his people. That is, let me review for you. These kings of Persia, the one will strip the prince of Greece. Greece will invade. Alexander the Great will die. And then note this. Now here you see. The character of this prediction, I got a couple more minutes, so tune me in. I'll put some things together for you. We looked at all these boring details. We've looked at it atomistically. Let's look at it holistically now. Note the proportion of this prophecy. Daniel is concerned about his people. And note what short shrift the teller of the vision, the teller of the prophecy, gives to Persia. It was real quick. Three kings are going to arise. Strip the king of Greece, he's going to come, he's going to fall. Four are going to arise. Very little detail. Covers a vast period of time. Many wars, marathon, you know, the wars between Persia and Greece. But then when he comes down to focus on Jerusalem and the temple and the people and the people of God, then he begins to go into detail. This is what's going to happen. This is what's going to happen. Why? See, this was Daniel's concern. The temple, his people. This is what's going to happen. In some detail. Why do you suppose he did all this? And so that Daniel would know that God was in control, that God is not surprised. And we've talked about the general purposes before. But to see that God was going to protect his people and God was going to be in it. It is a message of hope that God is in control. It is a message of repentance because God is in control. Okay, we'll be off of the thing.
We have a chapter tomorrow. We have a class tomorrow. Chapter 10,
you're right. That's the only one that's changed. This class, thank you very much. This is the only class that's different. None of the other classes are changed, are they? Okay, so we meet here. We meet tomorrow, not Friday. Same thing. I won't count you absent then.
Okay. Who's the king in the north?
Well, is that Antiochus? No, it's the Seleucids. Different ones. Okay. Whoever's in power is the Seleucid.
So then, the first king of the north.
The Seleucids.
Yeah, that's Antiochus the second. Then it comes down to Antiochus the great. Antiochus the second is Antiochus the Seleucid.